I'm very, very pleased and honored to tell you that to deliver our keynote address at this historic convention, we have invited a luminary in the struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. I first met Richard Falk in 1978 in Princeton, New Jersey, on my way to Iran. The Shah was in power. The United States had put the Shah in power after the CIA had engineered a coup against Mohammad Mossadegh. And the Shah was a terrorist and a tyrant and a horrible, horrible leader who oppressed his people. And I was going as a human rights observer for the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. And I actually stayed with Richard and his family in Princeton, and he briefed me on Iran. He was an expert on Iran, as he is an expert on so many things, which you will, of course, find out tonight. And I'm proud to say that he has remained my friend and my colleague all these years. Richard Falk is Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor in Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His most recent books are The Costs of War, International Law, the UN, and World Order After Iraq, published in 2008, and Achieving Human Rights, published in 2009. In 2001, Professor Falk served on a three-person human rights inquiry commission for the Palestinian territories that was appointed by the United Nations and previously on the Independent International Commission on Kosovo. On March 26, 2008, the UN Human Rights Council appointed Professor Falk to a six-year term as a United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. Professor Falk is the author or co-author of books too numerous to list, but I'll just list a couple of them for you, a few of them. Religion and Humane Global Governance, Human Rights Horizons, On Humane Governance Toward a New Global Politics, Exploration at the Edge of Time, Revolutionaries and Functionaries, The Promise of World Order, Indefensible Weapons, Human Rights and State Sovereignty, A Study of Future Worlds, This Endangered Planet, and he is co-editor of Crimes of War. Professor Falk serves as chair of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's Board of Directors and is honorary vice president of the American Society of International Law. He has also acted as counsel to Ethiopia and Liberia in the Southwest Africa case before the International Court of Justice. He received his B.S. from the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, his LLB from Yale Law School, and JSD from Harvard University. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Richard Falk.
Good evening. It's very difficult to live up to such an introduction, but I'm very thrilled to be here with you at this annual meeting of the National Lawyers Guild, and I'm particularly happy to have been introduced by Marjorie Cohn, whose work I've admired very much throughout the Bush period. Particularly, she was one of those voices of truth and caring about the significance of respecting international law if we want to live in a humane world. And as much as anyone, she kept that fire of hope and outrage, you know, that kind of extraordinary tension between hope and outrage, which I think was the way to creatively respond to the challenge posed by the Bush presidency and the neoconservative way of trying to colonize the world in the post-colonial era. I wanted to also say just a word about the National Lawyers Guild, which I think for me, allowed me to see for a long time that law didn't have to only be the high-paid work of Wall Street functionaries, that there was another dimension to the vocation of law and lawyers that had to do with a commitment to democracy and justice, equality, and in a sense was not bounded by any kind of special interests, but rather deemed the public interest, whether at home or abroad, and conveyed to all of us the sense that there is in this period a reality to human solidarity that transcends the narrowness of traditional nationalism and traditional patriotism, that the true patriots of the 21st century are members of the human race, not members of any particular ethnicity or religion or country, although all of those can be part of one's identity so long as they're subordinated to this sense of what it means to be human and to care for the future of the planet. And unless that kind of understanding becomes a ideological pandemic, we will not very long survive as a species. In other words, we are challenged in this period to adopt a understanding and orientation toward law and justice, not only for the sake of compassion and empathy with those that are suffering, but also for the sustainability of the future. Because unless we can rid ourselves of addictive militarism and this perpetuation of an imperial set of commitments and ambitions in what I already called a post-colonial era. And I emphasize that kind of disconnect between the great historical transformation of the 20th century, which was to rid the world pretty much of formal colonialism and formal empire, only to have that great emancipatory movement neutralized to a significant degree by this emergence of Pax Americana and the new reality of empire in post-colonial historical space, which we're only beginning to understand what it means and what it is. It's a new kind of animal that is taking shape as we speak, so to say. In trying to discuss the Obama presidency in relation to this background, I, like many other people, feel a certain discomfort, because when Barack Obama was elected, it was one of the happy political moments of my life. And I felt, for that moment, proud to be an American, proud to have been at least a witness of the first global election because as popular as Obama was at that time in this country, he would have won by a much bigger landslide if the disenfranchised part of the world had been allowed to vote in our election. And in a certain, if one really believed in democracy in a non-territorial sense, the rest of the world really has a great, often a greater stake in the outcome of American elections than they do of their own, and a great interest in that outcome. And if we really wanted to have a global democracy, they should participate in our elections, and I'm sure our leadership would benefit from such global participation. And maybe some of you who are young will live to see that happen. It would be a much more interesting and likely much more equitable kind of world order that emerged. So that to come to the point of expressing disappointment and struggling against prematurely repudiating this Obama leadership, I think is something that represents this sense of not wanting to let go altogether of the joy that his success, I think, legitimately caused. At the same time, there were warning signs even during his campaign. It was clear that either by conviction or by calculation, he felt it necessary to balance his call for a end to the Iraq war with a corresponding call for an escalated presence in the Afghanistan war, and seemed to express the disturbing related view that Afghanistan, the Afghanistan war inevitably meant also an engagement with Pakistan. And of course a very dangerous kind of engagement because of the size of Pakistan, its already very strong resentment about the U.S. role in the region, and its possession of nuclear weapons. All of those factors make one very worried about this kind of exchange of wars. And it seemed to convey the sense that you can't be electable in the United States unless you at least have one war that you're prepared to promote and promise to win. And as you know, in this context also, there was this disturbing sense that Iraq could be overcome because it was a so-called war of choice, whereas Afghanistan needed to be a war that would end with an American-led victory, because it was, in Obama's terminology and borrowed from the journal, from journalistic jargon, a war of necessity. And what was the necessity has never been really conveyed in a persuasive way, which is, I think, not an accident. Because if one thinks about it, what is the threat, the security threat posed by whatever the outcome is in Afghanistan. The Taliban is not a pleasant political formation, although it's perhaps changed its character somewhat over the years. But it's a national movement. It's concerned with governing Afghanistan. It doesn't have an international perspective, international reach. Even if we accept totally the official understanding of Al-Qaeda as this terrorist network with a belligerent attitude toward the United States and the responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and therefore dangerous as a actor, the notion that it is any more dangerous if the Taliban governs Afghanistan is, in my view, completely without any foundation in fact. The Al-Qaeda threat is essentially conceptual. It's not military. We see these commando training films, but they have nothing to do with either 9/11 or any of the other kind of operations that Al-Qaeda has been alleged to be involved with. And they could be planned in the basement of someone's home. They don't need a so-called failed state or a sanctuary. If the threat exists, it exists conceptually and can be generated from anywhere. And if you really were to try to address that threat, you would have to have total global surveillance 24/7. There is no security in the conventional sense against that threat, and the best you can hope for is effective law enforcement. That's the best you can hope for, and the only relevant way of reducing the threat. So what I'm trying to suggest is that we are being given a false debate about what is at stake in Afghanistan. And it's a debate that goes on as if these threats are real, that something terrible will happen to American security if indeed the Taliban prevails or if Al-Qaeda somehow reestablishes some kind of presence in Afghanistan. But remember, Al-Qaeda can establish a presence anywhere, and it doesn't need military capabilities, it doesn't need great resources. All it needs is the willingness of its militants to be prepared to die in some kind of suicidal operation that depends on the vulnerability of high technology societies that have many points of vulnerability. In other words, one of the things that 9/11 did establish is that military superiority and military dominance are not relevant to security, and that the United States is probably the most powerful military actor in world history. It is the most powerful in world history, and yet it has never felt more insecure as a country. And so that kind of reinterpretation of what really is security in the 21st century, and doesn't it really depend on law and justice because the motivation of people desperate enough to kill themselves usually is a reaction against some kind of injustice. People don't engage in suicidal enterprises without a deep motivation of some kind. That doesn't mean that what they do is acceptable, but what it does do is, if we want to address that threat, you have to address the grievance that gives rise to this extreme behavior. You can't hope exterminate the actor without addressing the cause of the action. And that's, you find almost no recognition of that, the relevance of legitimate grievances to the degree to which the security of liberal democracies is threatened by this kind of extremism. And it seems to me that's an important kind of understanding to achieve. The Obama presidency is disappointing because it seems not to have, it seems unwilling to really re-examine the premises of counterinsurgency warfare. Counterinsurgency warfare, which was the essence of which was the Vietnam intervention, is the characteristic way that an imperial state uses force in the 21st century. It doesn't try to conquer foreign countries, but what it does try to do is to intervene militarily and control the political destiny of those countries. And in that sense, it violates the most fundamental norm that has emerged in international law in the last century, namely the right of all peoples to self-determination, to control their own political destiny. And the nature of counterinsurgency is to deny that right. And therefore, it is to deny the history of our time. It is a repudiation, in a sense, of the struggle against colonialism. And it is a denial of this most basic right that people have to shape their own future. And because people have that right, and know they have, see, what is different in our time is not only do people have the right, but they know they have the right, and they know that if they struggle, they can prevail against a militarily stronger adversary. See, that is the Achilles heel, so to speak, of militarism, that it can no longer win in these prolonged counterinsurgency struggles. At the same time, it can't accept that lesson of history, because it would put the military out of business. So it has to keep reinventing counterinsurgency warfare and explaining defeat as a mistake of doctrine. So General Petraeus has become very prominent because he's repackaged counterinsurgency warfare in a way that is thought to be sensitive to the defeat in Vietnam. There was an interesting exchange between two colonels, a Vietnamese colonel and an American colonel, shortly after the Vietnam War. And the American colonel proudly said, you know, You never beat us on the battlefield. And the Vietnamese colonel, whose name was Tu, responded rather profoundly in my view. And he said, "That may be true, but it is irrelevant." See, and there is a real deep insight into the changing relation of forces in the world in this recent period, that a determined movement of liberation, particularly if it mobilizes solidarity outs beyond its field of struggle, as the Vietnamese did, as Marjorie mentioned, and as the anti-apartheid movement spectacularly did, and as the Palestinian struggle is increasingly doing, that what I call the second war, the legitimacy war, often is shaping the political outcomes in these prolonged struggles. In other words, you can win every battle and lose the war. You can have complete control of the air, the sea, the land, and somehow not be able to translate that military dominance into a political victory. See, and that's what the Pentagon can't learn. It's in denial. At least that's a charitable way of putting it. Maybe it's suppressing what it... No, I mean, the more less charitable way. I suspect it is some kind of mixture. But insignificantly, the U.S. as an imperial power in decline. The dollar is declining. The acceptability of the American presence around the world is drawn into increasing question. And it is typical of declining empires to accentuate their military superiority. And of course, that often strains their financial capability. So that if you look at the history of imperial collapses, it's usually a mixture of overextension geographically and financially. And the U.S. is very vulnerable in these respects. It now spends as much as the whole world put together to sustain its military machine. That's a startling figure. It has between 700 and 1,000 military bases spread around the world in at least 60 countries. No other state has anything approaching this. It has navies in every ocean, and it has invested heavily in the military dominance of space. In other words, it has staked its imperial destiny on the relevance of military dominance to political control and to economic expansion. And that I think is the lesson that is far from being learned. One wonders what the people in Oslo were exactly thinking when they awarded our president the Nobel Prize. It at least has given the talk show host something to make fun of, and that's not, I suppose, without its value. But and someone has compared this Nobel Prize for Obama to a Pulitzer Prize for Sarah Palin. because she promised to read a book someday. And another explanation of the prize was that at least Obama has shown that he can make peace with Hillary Clinton. But on a more serious level, it almost seems Orwellian to confer the Nobel Peace Prize on a political leader that is escalating an unlawful war and is in a threatening Iran militarily and is neglecting the humanitarian catastrophe that is befalling the Palestinian people. How can one justify, what were they thinking that could, you know, that Norway's a little country and maybe they don't read about other parts of the world, but still. And the latent militarism of giving the Peace War Award to Obama at this moment was underlined for me by a column that Thomas Friedman wrote in the New York Times that some of you may have seen, in which in characteristic arrogant fashion he writes the speech that he wants Obama to deliver in Oslo when he accepts the award. And what he says, I think, without irony, and I quote it, "I cannot accept this award on my behalf at all, but I will accept it on behalf of the most important peacekeepers in the world for the last century, the men and women of the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps." Friedman goes on to thank the American military for their role in both the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. And he ends his speech with these somewhat surrealistic words, and I quote again, "So for all these reasons, and so you understand that I will never hesitate to call for American soldiers where necessary to fight against the enemies of peace, tolerance, and liberty. I accept this prize on behalf of the men and women of the U.S. military, the world's most important peacekeepers." I give this attention to Friedman not because I think he's a wise man, but because I do think that unintentionally, he does reveal the true nature of this award. He's right in a way. This is what I'm sure Obama is sensible enough not to say these things, but this is in a way what the award represents. In a sense, it seems to move in that direction, disturbingly. And I wanted to mention one other element of this hostile relationship to the restraining role of law in relation to force, which is the fundamental promise of the United Nations and the UN Charter. And it's something that no American president, in all honesty, has felt obliged to respect. So in that sense, Obama is no different than even if we had some higher expectations for him. But I wanted to refer very briefly to the way in which the U.S. government responded to the Goldstone report on war crimes allegations arising out of the Gaza attacks launched by Israel last winter. Because here was a very sober, methodical report, completely consistent with a commitment to the rule of law, to the notions of accountability that go back to the Nuremberg judgment after World War II, and something that seemed to suggest that finally the international community was going to do something about Israeli impunity in relation to the way in which they have abused their role as an occupying power for all these 42 years, which is an incredible length of time for a people to be. It's, in a sense, an abuse of human rights, the very nature of that prolonged occupation. But, and Richard Goldstone, who is the chair of this fact-finding mission of the Human Rights Council, is, in a sense, the perfect Israeli choice to be the chair of such an investigation. He's a lifelong Zionist, close to the American government. He's on the board of trustees of Hebrew University. He has deep family connections. But it is true, he was a member of the South African Constitutional Court. He was an opponent of apartheid. He believes in the rule of law. And the truth is that anyone with even 20% open mind would have had to come to these conclusions. You didn't need to be some sort of pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli critic to reach this kind of conclusion. And indeed, the Palestinians have more to object to about the report than do the Israelis, in my view. If it's unbalanced, it's unbalanced in terms of giving tremendous emphasis first to the Hamas wrongdoing, and secondly by neglecting the context in which the attacks were launched. The world has been misled to believe that the real issue is the disproportionate and indiscriminate nature of Israel's justifiable recourse to defensive measures. But the reality is that there was no grounds for claiming self-defense. There was a ceasefire that was working, and Hamas proposed extending it for 10 years. Things that just don't enter our media consciousness at all. So that what I think is significant beyond the let me emphasize just two things about this. The first is that the United States, that the Obama response to the Goldstone report was just what you would have expected in the years of George W. Bush. No different. It attacked it pretended the report was one-sided and unbalanced in its criticism of Israel. And it really resembled the Bush response to the World Court decision on the separation wall, which was a 14-to-1 decision ordering Israel to dismantle the wall and pay reparations. And again, was immediately dismissed by the U.S. government without reading the decision, and showed a contempt for international law, But see, this rejection of the Goldstone Report also shows a contempt for international law. But what I think is what is significant here is are both the somewhat hysterical reaction of the Israeli leadership, starting with their top leaders. Always in the past, the dismissal of international law has been just done in a routine bureaucratic way. You haven't had statements by the president, the prime minister, the defense minister. This struck a raw nerve, this report. And it is a challenge. It's important to understand what is that raw nerve? Why has Israel reacted in such a different way to the way it reacted to other things? But the other thing that I think is really interesting and significant is that the Palestinian Authority, which is a subordinate instrument in many ways of the U.S.-Israeli position, tried to, succumb to pressure to withdraw a resolution from the Human Rights Council that would have endorsed the recommendations of the Goldstone Report. And what is, that's not so, that's, I think, politically, terribly discrediting act on their part. But what is significant is the degree to which there was such a outrage from below, from the peoples of the region, from around the world, that there was no way that the Palestinian Authority could survive unless it reversed its position. And what this again shows is the extraordinary power that is dormant often, but is embedded in the peoples of the world. And that, and to me, that's whatever happens with the Goldstone Report. I think that's these two elements are extremely important to appreciate and to respond to. Let me bring my comments to an end with just a very brief set of reflections on the imperial moment, so to speak, in the Obama presidency. Why he was appreciated in Europe, and maybe the serious reason why he did receive the Nobel Prize, was that he abandoned the style, the militarist style and unilateralism of the Bush presidency. In other words, there's a change, definite change of style, of imperial style. Obama speaks toward a world, a cooperative world, a multilateral world, a world that uses diplomacy where possible. And that's that language of cooperation and reconciliation is important. But you have to go two steps beyond the imperial style to imperial policy and to imperial structure. And an imperial policy, as I've already indicated, he has sort of manipulated the, changed the pieces on the chessboard, but it's the same chessboard. And he's giving more attention to some of the pieces than were given to by Bush and less to others. But it's essentially playing the same game. And so there hasn't been a real change in imperial policy. And what is most important is no one dares touch imperial structure. See, the imperial structure is what is embedded in what long ago Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, and now it's 50 years later,
And it's embedded in the bureaucracy, in the media, in think tank, network of think tanks. It constrains the elected political leadership and conditions the exercise of presidential authority. One needs to accept the constraints of the Pentagon and its linkages to Wall Street and those linkages to Israel. That set of structural constraints means that it is that the policy choices are extremely narrow in their relevance to altering the direction. And as Madeleine Albright said a long time ago, what's the use of this military machine if we don't use it? And there is a there is something to that, again, as insensitive a remark as that was. And so I think there is a picture that emerges from all of this, which has several characteristics. One is that the military option is still being pursued despite its likely failure to yield success, and that it's rooted in this domestic governmental structure that has become removed from political accountability at home. And what this means is that our hopes have to lie with the mobilization of the citizenry. And it really does come back to the things that Marjorie said at the very beginning about what it is that the National Lawyers Guild has been doing, which is really the mobilization of lawyers and people around issues of justice, social and political and economic justice. And it's that mobilization that has to occur nationally and globally if we are to have any real hope of challenging this imperial structure, which is leading us to destruction. It's not just a matter of being nice to the rest of the world. It's also a matter of being nice to ourselves and to future generations. Let me end with a few lines from a poem by a German poet named Günter Eich, and I read, "No, don't sleep while the arrangers of the world are busy. Be suspicious of the power they claim to have to acquire on your behalf. Stay awake to be sure that your hearts are not empty when others calculate on the emptiness of your hearts. Do what is unhelpful. Sing songs from out of your mouths that go against expectations. Be a resistor. Be as sand, not oil, in the thirsty machine, in the thirsty machinery of the world." Thank you.